from WXXI News. This is Connections. I'm Evan Dawson. Our connection for this hour was formed about a decade ago in the town of Malone, New York. You've probably never heard of Malone because it's nowhere near Rochester or the Finger Lakes. It's way up on the northern edge of the state. And it's a small town, but not tiny. Malone's population's about 15,000. Nearly a decade ago, a woman went to court seeking an order of protection against her husband. She was a mother of four, and her husband was abusive. The police in Malone said that her husband had choked her, kicked her in the stomach, and said that he would kill her. So she thought it was time to get away from him. But the town justice, Donald Roberts, had a different idea. He refused her request for an order of protection. And then, according to state records, he later told the court clerk, quote, "Every woman needs a good pounding every now and then." Think about a judge saying those words. Every woman needs a good pounding every now and then. Donald Roberts was a judge, but he had no legal degree. In New York State, town and village justices are not required to hold a law degree. Many do, many don't, and for those that don't, they attend a two-week schooling run by the New York State Magistrates Association. But there have been complaints over the years that it's time to change the requirements, and recently Democrat and Chronicle columnist David Andriotta raised the point in a column titled, "Village Judges Shouldn't Be Village Idiots." Now, we've reached out to a number of local justices. We're going to hear from the state's Office of Court Administration coming up. First, we welcome Dave Andriotta. Nice to see you here again.
Nice to be here, Evan. Thank you.
And let me also state for the record, the story from Malone I referenced, as I said, was reported in the New York Times in a lengthy story that they did on the same subject. And so this is not necessarily an overnight news story, but it's one that continues to be part of the fabric of our discussion about what courts should and shouldn't be. Fair enough, Dave?
Yeah, I think that's a fair assessment. I mean, the reason I did the column is because I thought back to that New York Times series, which is now quite dated, actually, yet many of the principles that it brings up still apply. I want to say it was from maybe 2007
Seven,
or so.
Yep. Yeah.
And the series of stories it was called Broken Bench, and it really highlighted some of the issues that we're talking about today. But it was very eye-opening for me. And even though what that reporter did at the time was simply just look at the public record and find all of these cases that anyone cases involving discipline of judges, anyone could have looked this up, but he put them into, you know, a succinct package of stories that for outsiders and people who weren't, at least at that time, I was not necessarily following the courts, it was very eye-opening. And it answered a lot of questions that I had at the time whenever I would see these stories, which seemed to occur once a month or so, where a judge does something silly. And it's usually somewhere far flung across the state in small towns and villages that we haven't heard of. And I'd always ask myself, who the heck are these people? And that time story was an eye-opener for me. Now, because it's so dated, I thought I might just revisit and touch on that topic with the column I did a couple of weeks ago after there was news about a Village of Waterloo court judge who claimed to have been attacked outside of his courthouse, and there is some dispute over whether that actually occurred. And
he might have made that story up.
Yeah, right. That's what investigators are saying, and the lunacy of the claim just, I think, reinforced this idea of this question of who are these people. I mean, he described being hit over the head by a toilet tank lid outside of his Seneca County courthouse in Waterloo. And the investigators later found, or they're claiming that he made the whole thing up to make it, you know, even more crazy.
Yeah.
He is also being accused of stealing gasoline from the village cemetery where he was the sexton, which is the caretaker of the cemetery. So, you know, these types of things. When I read that story, I thought to myself, again, there are people out there who are reading that story and saying, who the heck are these people? And I tried in the 650 words or so that I'm allotted, I tried to shed a little light with a little humor.
You did. And let me also make clear that in this discussion, we're not here to malign all town court judges. And you say the exact same thing in your piece. You say most of them are people who have a good record of public service, who want to do well. And depending on where you are in the state, more rural, you might see a mix of people with law degrees, and with no law degrees, you might see a bunch of sort of villages and towns strung together where you don't see a judge with a law degree. Up here, you see most town judges with law degrees, but not all. And I want to stress, the point is not to say, you know, whoever your town judge is or justice is, that there's some sort of a flaw on, with all of them. Hardly the case. It's more looking at the fact that I chose the case from Malone that the New York Times reported on. You talked about a judge in Waterloo. Those stories are not everyday common, but the fact that they still can happen should be somewhat concerning to those of us because ton judge justices have power. They can send you to jail for a year.
Sure. Sure. I think it's actually up to 2 years.
Yeah, I think two consecutive one-year terms, right. They can. They deal with orders of protection, as we saw, which is a hugely important issue.
Well, it was what was interesting to me is we heard about the TGI Fridays mom was recently in the news. The story about the woman who left her child in the car was charged with child endangerment charges. And I heard from someone who read a story that I wrote about the order of protection that barred her from seeing her child for 6 months. I'm not going to opine on whether that or not that was right or wrong, but someone had informed me that the Farmington town judge who issued that order of protection was not a lawyer. And can you believe this? And I said to myself, all the more reason to write this column people like that.
Exactly right. So we're going to be exploring sort of the way that this process works. And I want to bring in someone on the phone who is a local attorney who happens to be out of town, but he's nice enough to spend some time with us on the phone. And that's Matthew Rich. He's an attorney who does criminal defense and family court work and often appears in front of town justices. Is that right, Matt?
Sure is. Hi, Evan. How are you today?
Good. Thanks for taking the time to join us, Matt. Now, you work in front of town justices with regularity. You and I spoke briefly last week about this, and you said your experience with them has been largely positive, right?
Yes. It's like anything else, Evan. In any profession, any walk of life, there's going to be good apples, and there's going to be bad apples. But I can tell you in 10-plus years of criminal practice, some of the stories you've described, I've never run into anything with those levels of ridiculousness, if that's a word. What I'll say is, you know, there's often times when a judge will make a decision that either side might disagree with or a victim might disagree with, but that's par for the course. That's part of it. And that being said, I've never, some of the buffoonery you just laid out has never been anything I've seen.
Yeah, I should also point out that the New York Times, in the story we referenced and in other stories, have referenced some numbers. The latest numbers I've seen are that local justices, town and village, make up roughly two-thirds of the judges in the state, but they account for more than three-quarters of the removals. So there's a disproportionate number of complaints that result in judges being removed for judges at the local level, and you can probably conclude that it are something to do with some of these strange stories we're talking about. Matthew, I'm glad to hear that you haven't experienced anything quite that ludicrous, but it's also fair to ask you, if you have a client in front of a town court justice and you're not satisfied with the way the process has gone and that justice doesn't have a law degree, does that make an appeal easier or more logical for you to say, look, we have to end up in front of someone with a degree because they're deciding, say, a traffic ticket and a 10-day incarceration. Say it's a B misdemeanor, whatever it is. Does that make it easier to appeal?
Well, I think it's important to understand the process for that. There's, for decisions made in local court, the next court of appeal to go to is Monroe County Court, or if you're in Ontario County Supreme, you know, in the outlying counties. You don't go right to the appellate division. You go to the county court is where you can appeal to. And the judges there, obviously, you have to have a law degree, obviously, to sit on a superior court like that. So that's one thing you can do. The other thing is a lot of times you'll disagree with judges setting bail at a local court. And again, the remedy is to go to county court. You go to what they call the Part 1 judge in county court, which is essentially the on-call judge for the month. You contact whoever the on-call ADA at the district attorney's offices, and you go over and you make a bail application in front of at higher court. So there's always a remedy you can seek out if you find the decision is unfair or you disagree with it. The bail application process happens with some measure of frequency. That happens all the time. So it is not as if once bail is set, for example, that ends the inquiry. No, you always have an outlet to go to challenge that or to try to get a different decision. So there's always those opportunities.
Let me grab a phone call. And again, if you want to weigh in on a number of angles here, we're going to be talking about how judges are I guess schooled or trained is the word we can describe. We're going to talk about that, and we're going to hear from some other voices as well. Matthew Rich is on the phone with us, an attorney who works in criminal defense and often appears in front of town court justices. Dave Andriotta, who wrote the recent piece in the Democrat and Chronicle that sparked this discussion, is in studio with us. And this is Will in Mendon. Will, thanks for calling.
Yeah, thank you for taking the call. Just an observation. I've practiced in these courts over the years, and it's been my observation that, yes, you can disagree with any judge in any court about the exercise of her or his discretion, but the problem with non-lawyers in town and village courts is, all too frequently, they don't know what the law is, and they're just shooting from the hip with feelings and thoughts that are unrelated to law. And secondly, the whole notion of an appeal, whether it's a bail decision or an appeal in a civil or a criminal case, is your speaker is correct in theory, but the practical nature of the situation is, A, you got to have a lawyer. B, lawyers cost a lot of money. C, it just extends the process inordinately long. And the ultimate problem is that 95% of the people in this community and across the state get their first impression from the local courts, whether they're criminal or civil. And if they don't see if they have a lawyer and the lawyer says, well, you're right on the facts and the law, and then they ask the lawyer, well, that means I'm going to win? And the lawyer says, well, I don't know. We've got a judge who really doesn't know the law, and maybe you will, maybe you won't. It undercuts the legitimacy of the whole legal process.
Will, hang in there. Let's let Matthew Rich respond to that. Go ahead, Matthew.
You bet.
Well, let me give you a very local example. Okay, so in Irondequoit, they have three judges, Patrick Rusty and Joseph Valentino Jr., and then the third one is Judge Joseph Jr. Judge Valentino and Judge Rusty are both attorneys. Judge Jr. is not. I have been just as comfortable appearing in front of Judge Jr. as the other two. I am just as confident in his ability to know, understand, and apply the law as I have been in the other two. And that's only one local example. I can give you another example out in Swedentown Court, which encompasses the town and village of Brockport. Judge Robert Connors is an excellent judge, not a lawyer. What it comes down to, I think, is experience. It comes down to training. And it comes down to, if you don't know the answer to a question, seek out the answer from somebody who does. Local judges have available to them a hotline, which is set up by, I believe, the Office of Court Administration, that is staffed during working hours with judges who are basically on call to answer questions.
I'd like to comment, if I can.
Go ahead, Will. Go ahead.
Well, the comment is that, again, that's all great in theory, but frequently, especially in only in criminal cases, you see local judges who are not lawyers rely on the counsel of the prosecutor, of the assistant district attorney, and that's absolutely the wrong source of information because the way the system of justice is supposed to work, two equally matched sides, ADA and defense lawyer, and the judge is not supposed to be looking either to the defendant's lawyer or to the prosecutor to understand the law. And your speaker, I'm sure, has seen that happen all too often.
Well, actually, Matthew Rich is a great person to answer this because he was a prosecuting attorney and now he works on the criminal defense side. So, Matthew, what do you think about that?
Well, I have to disagree with Will's statement in one sense, that the judge should not look to the parties for, you know, analysis as to the law. Well, I think, of course, a judge should hear both sides' arguments and take
into account. That's not what I'm saying.
Sides. Well, let me finish, sir. What I will also say is, in, you know, almost eight years that I was with the district attorney's office, I never remember a judge pulling me into a room alone and asking for, well, what should I do here? I mean, it just doesn't work that way.
Judge pulled anybody into a room and asked them alone. I say they turn to the prosecutor and say, well, should I dismiss this case? And because I don't know what the law is. And the prosecutor will give them the law in court, on the record, in front of everybody else. I've observed it over 41 years of practice.
All right, Will, thanks for the call. And Matthew, tell me if I'm right or wrong here, and Dave Andriotta as well. Tell me if I'm right or wrong. The scenario that Will is posing, it would be rather simple for a defense attorney to then say, to file a complaint and say, look, you have a judge here who doesn't know the law and is just asking the prosecutor what to do, as opposed to, if they don't know, using the hotline that's set up and established. I mean, Matthew, isn't that what they should? And from what you've seen, isn't that more common?
I have to, again, disagree with that gentleman's assessment of things. In the 8 years I was a prosecutor, I never had anything like that happen. I never had a judge say to me, what should I do here? In fact, it was almost quite the opposite, that judges didn't want necessarily to hear from only one side. They always wanted to hear from both sides, and especially it applied to experienced criminal defense attorneys who obviously their opinions and their arguments carry a lot of weight because of, you know, the reputations that precede them. But I that gentleman, I don't know what experiences he has had. I have never had those experiences.
Attorney Matthew Rich is on the phone with us. Dave Andriotta, columnist for the Democrat and Chronicle, is in studio. We're talking about village and town justices and whether they ought to have law degrees and whether there should be changes. So, Dave, you had to look into, for your column, you had to look into not only the question of the fact that they don't have law degrees, but then the question of how they're trained. My understanding is it's roughly a two-week training by the New York State Magistrates Association. That's not 3 years of law school, but that's right. At least something to help establish some basis. And then there is that hotline, and there's always support for additional training that I've at least heard about. Is that the same you've heard?
Yeah, I think you nailed it. I don't know that I could expand on it anymore. It's a 2 week course. They do have weekend training seminars that are available to them, and it's my impression that many judges, if not most, are very diligent in trying to attend those seminars. But that is really the crux of the education. But I just want to jump in on something here.
Yeah.
That I think can help put the debate we just had between the caller and Matt into some perspective. To Matt's point that he has never encountered a judge that seems incompetent or is bumbling a case that he has before him. The number of cases we're talking – discipline cases we're talking about since 1978, okay, that the state – Commission on Judicial Conduct has handed down are 780 cases. The vast majority of them, about 550, involved town and village judges. So this is the reason that they are in the news. When the commission hands down some sort of sanction or discipline or removal, there's typically a press release that goes out. Frankly, the cases that involve town and village justices are usually so much more egregious than those that involve state-paid judges that the state-paid judges' cases don't even make the news because it's something so inside baseball that no one would care about, as opposed to a judge, holding an arraignment for her son in her kitchen or something like that,
right.
Which actually was a case that happened that the New York Times focused on. So, and you can see the problem with that. So we're not talking about a ton of cases. It's about I'd say a dozen to 15 a year. But
yeah.
Those cases are typically so egregious that they make the news, and this is why they pop up. So it doesn't surprise me that Matt has not had that experience with the judge at all. And like you said at the outset, this is not to suggest that all of these judges are bad. I mean, admission to the bar is no guarantee that judges will be fluent in the complexities of a case before them. That being said, I think there are some arguments as to why judges should have a law degree. But now to back, I think, the caller's point. In 2008, a special commission on the future of New York State courts was established by the chief judge. And it was in response to that. I don't know if it was in response to, but it certainly followed that New York Times story. And that commission actually ended up saying, you know, we don't think we should abolish the non-attorney judge role. But that was because it was a question of practicality. And I'm going to quote from it. Quote, most commissioners agree that in a perfect world, all local justices would be attorneys. End quote. New quote, we have seen considerable evidence that many non-attorneys face difficulties handling complex motions and misdemeanor jury trials. End quote. And they go on to describe that justices leave the bench, that they've seen examples of justices leaving the bench routinely to call the resource center and expressed, quote unquote, panic when confronted with some complex legal issues. Prior to that, in 2006, and not to get too into the weeds here, but there was an action plan for New York State judges I'll read a quote from that.
Yep.
The unique education that law school provides can empower judges to discern, apply, and shape the law in ways that non-attorneys can find difficult, if not impossible, and that in the end quote, all judges must be proficient in the law. And for this reason, the Constitution requires state-paid judges to be admitted to the bar for 5 to 10 years before sitting on the bench. It's very clear that we have two tiers of a judicial system here. And I think there's a strong argument to be made that, you know, it's a good idea to have these judges have law degrees.
Okay. And so – but you've also been, I think, at least in my conversations with you over the last few days, and again, talking to Dave Andreotta from the Democrat and Chronicle, you've been open to the argument that says in the smallest towns and villages, there may not be a lawyer. And, you know, so this requirement may be good as an idealistic goal, but it might not be doable in practice. What happens – what do you view as a solution in that case?
Well, you know, I'm by far not an expert on this issue. I want to make that clear. But I do have my opinions. And my opinions are based on what came out of those commissions,
yeah.
which frankly said that a district court system might be a way to go. It points out that, you know, critics of a district court system would say, well, then instead of going to your home court, a couple miles from your home, you're going to be driving 30 miles in bad weather. The commission found that, as a matter of fact, a third of cases involved people traveling 20 plus miles anyway, because typically the offense that they're going to court for is not even in their hometown. So what's the difference? And what kind of sense does it make to have village judges in – I live in Fairport – East Rochester, Fairport, and Pittsford. I mean, I go to the grocery store in all three of those places. They're right next door to each other. And that's another topic about consolidation of local governments and whatnot. But I think it can be applied to this argument in that we see in some counties there are 48 justice slots and only 50 registered attorneys registered with the bar. Okay, that's obviously not going to work. But the question is, do you really need 48 justice slots? I think that's the larger issue, and I think if you could pare it down to have a district or, it wouldn't be called a county court, but some sort of court at the county level that wouldn't have to have 48 justices, you might actually be able to have to foster more competence on the bench.
And that would get you around the issue of if a small town or village didn't have a lawyer. Matthew Rich, attorney, what are your thoughts about that?
Well, they have that system on Long Island, both Suffolk County and Nassau County use a district court model. My question before, you know, we decide to dismantle almost over 200 years of jurisprudence and radically change the judicial landscape in New York State, we had better figure out, number one, is such a district court model more efficient, meaning does it get cases through the process in a speedier and a timelier fashion? And number two, does it result in a cost savings to the taxpayer when you establish a central location such as that? I don't – if we were to do something like that in Monroe County, we don't have – say we went to two. Say we went to an east, you know, the eastern half of Monroe County had one and the western half of Monroe County had one. Off the top of my head, I'm not aware of a facility in either the eastern or the western suburbs that could accommodate that, where, you know, I would assume you would need 8 to 10 judges on such a district court for each side of the county. What this would result in is we'd have to build facilities from scratch to meet those needs. You'd have to staff those facilities with law clerks, in-court clerks, secretaries, things of that nature. I don't know that any of that would result in a more efficient or cost-effective process than we have currently.
We are blowing up on the phones, and so before we get to our next phone guest, I want Matt to hang in there while we get a couple more calls, and this is Edward and Henrietta. Edward, go ahead.
Oh, yes, hello. I have a question. My understanding that the whole idea of the hierarchy of our judicial system is to enforce some kind of uniformity of the law through the system. Am I correct?
Uniformity of law through the system. Yeah, I think you want consistency, sure.
Yeah. And I just don't want to mention the name of the court I was present in, but the judge there, on my objection to the hearsay, announced, in my court, hearsay is allowed. How would you like that?
Well, your description of this is hearsay. I don't know if I can trust it ever, but let's assume it did happen that way. Matthew Rich, would you be concerned about that, hearing that?
Well, you have to be aware, Evan, that in certain proceedings,
such as pretrial hearings, hearsay is admissible. So without knowing the context under which that statement was made,
I'm talking about the trial.
To answer the question.
Okay, he says he's talking about the trial. Let's just, again, we're now sort of in this weird meta discussion in which it's sort of hearsay about hearsay. But Matthew, let's assume that it was a situation where, you know, hearsay should not be admissible, and you heard a judge announce that in my courtroom hearsay is fine. Again, as an attorney, you can file a complaint, or what process would you undertake if you heard that, Matthew?
Well, if my client was, you know, convicted of whatever he was charged with, and during the course of the trial that announcement was made, or even worse, evidence like that was admitted, the next step is, as I described earlier, you file appeal with the county court, and you hash the issue out there.
Okay. Do you want to hear the continuation then?
Well, I will allow
it. It's up to you.
I'll consult with my attorney, and I'll allow it, but you're on a short leash. Go ahead.
Yes. The appeal did follow. The decision of the appeal judge was that the inferior court was in a better position to make the judgment because he had in its position all the evidence. So the appeal is denied.
Well, it's a strange case. I have to say that it sounds strange, and I hope it didn't play out exactly that way. I think, Dave Andriotta, I think it's fair to say that at least I've talked to several judges who did not want to come on this program. I reached out to a lot of local judges. I've talked to some county court judges, and I understand that it can be sensitive for them. But they said, look, in many ways, this system was established because on the local level, you wanted someone with a feel for the local texture. Not to say you're going to hold an arraignment for your child in your family room or in your kitchen, but to say, do you have a bit of more of the rhythm of the community to understand certain matters that a judge who may be more of sort of a district scenario judge wouldn't have. Again, that sort of precedes the fact that judges now have local judges have a lot of power, and that you've got to be careful. But there is a value of at least having a judge who understands the community, I would think.
I think absolutely. I would agree with that. There is a problem sometimes with too much familiarity. And a third of these cases in which sanctions are issued by the state Commission on Judicial Conduct, a third of the cases involve ethical violations that stem from a judge's familiarity with the party. But that said, there is a quaintness and a hominess that sometimes come with these courts that can serve the people that they're meant to serve more efficiently. If I can just share, I'll try to sum this up very quickly.
Yeah.
A personal story. Years ago, it was in the mid-1990s, I was issued a ticket, a driving infraction, actually a pair of them, on the thruway at Junius Pond's rest stop.
And I was just there, David. I know.
Right. Well, this was a real boneheaded move by me. The guy I was driving with, the driver had to use the restroom, didn't even want to wait to park, so he parked in a no parking spot, said, take over the driver's seat, and if anyone bothers you, just, you know, move it. Well, it was a Volkswagen, and I wasn't familiar with a stick shift that where the reverse was above first, and so ultimately when a policeman said move the car, and I couldn't, he gave me a ticket for some sort of moving violation, which I can't remember what it was at this point. My point is, I was 19 years old. I blew off the ticket. They're never going to catch me. I'm in college. Next thing I know, I get a warrant in the mail, and I'm freaking out. I didn't know what to do. There was, you know, I missed all my court dates and everything to answer this charge. And so I, you know, called 411, looked up the name of the judge, called this guy at home, which he was none too pleased about. But to his credit, he gave me sort of a talking to of akin to a son. It'll be okay. Just follow my instructions. And he talked me through it, and the issue went away. I paid the ticket, of course. My point of all this is you know, try that with a state judge.
Yeah,
try calling a judge at home and
right.
getting that kind of remedy.
Right.
It's not going to happen. So. You know, to your point, there is something about the quaintness and the familiarity that these judges have with local issues that, you know, they can take the time to talk to.
Let me grab one more listener call before we move to our next guest. And this is Keith in Henrietta. Keith, thanks for calling.
Evan, good show. A couple comments and two examples I'd like to pass on. I believe just keep them as they are, but have some sort of overview. Have some sort of agency occasionally come in and look at Judge Bob's rulings and see if they are too follow the letter of the law. And if they don't, well, then you either send them off for training or you say, well, you can't do this anymore because you suck at it. But just making them an attorney or having legal background, there's no guarantee they're going to be any better. I mean, we have a Congress full of attorneys, and look how bad they are. We have a state legislature that's a vast majority of attorneys, and look how poorly they operate. But I'll give you two examples of egregious actions. One was a parking ticket I got. I got went pled not guilty. I thought I still got convicted of it. I said, I want to appeal this. I go before the appeal. And who's on the appeal board but the husband of the judge who didn't see it my way the first time? That was one instance. And then the second time, I sold a used car in the mid-'80s for $250. Sold it as is. Okay? $250. 30 days later, I get an action in the mail from small claims court that the woman was suing me because it needed a radiator. I go, oh, this is going to be cut and dry. I go to the court. We both say our say. I show him the receipt as is. He says, okay, I'm going to rule on it. Sends me a notification that I owe her the $250, and she's going to give me the car back. And now we're like 90 days after it. I was livid. How could anybody rule so stupidly? I appealed that, and I have no idea whatever happened because nothing happened. But there should be some oversight on the town judges where somebody with a little bit more knowledge, maybe students on an internship, review all the town actions and say victory.
Well, Keith, thank you for sharing the stories. I promise our next guest is going to talk oversight, and we're going to, if you missed some of our discussion about that, there is a process in case you don't think judges are handling it well. Before I let you go, Matthew Rich, I assume as an attorney who now works in front of town justices, you would not make changes to the system, or are there any small changes you would like to see made?
Well, I don't think some of Keith's suggestions are all that out of bounds.
Okay.
Currently, they have an auditing process in the town courts, and you hear a lot of times, it doesn't happen with great frequency, but you hear every once in a while, say a court clerk or somebody working on the staff will get caught with discrepancies as to fine money, or there's even an example from a few years back where an individual was helping themselves to the driver's licenses that had been suspended at arraignments on DWIs. So there's audit processes that go on as far as the finances and things like that go. As far as the legal rulings go, that would be a gargantuan task. I mean, our largest town courts in our county, which probably are Henrietta, Greece, courts like that, Gates, that handle high volumes of cases, you're talking about tens of thousands of cases, thousands and thousands of rulings every year. Nobody could go over every single one of those with any sort of ability to do it in a timely fashion. And I think it's somewhat unfair to, pick and choose, what is to be looked at and what isn't. But what I will say is maybe the thing that needs to happen, because I'm sensing some, angst from the public about this, is the process by which a judge can be called into question maybe needs to be made more. Maybe needs to be some more publicity attached to it. Maybe something along the lines of a brochure available at every courthouse. And if there is such a thing, I'm not aware of it. Maybe there is, but I've never seen it. Where you could file a formal complaint and somebody can take a look into it. But beyond that, given the strains that the local judiciary operates under, I think they do, on the whole, a very good job handling it, considering the level of funding and the level of support they get, and also considering just how many individual cases, from traffic tickets to arraignments on felony matters and everything in between, go through these systems. I think Dave referenced something on the order of 700 and some complaints or substantiated issues during the time period of that study. When you compare that to the number of cases that go through this system, that is almost a minuscule amount. So can it improve? You can always improve the system. But to dismantle a tradition that goes back to colonial times, because that's where the local magistrate, it finds its origins in the English common law, and it finds its origins in our country going back to before New York State was even a state. To dismantle that far back of a tradition, I think you need to have sort of a systemic problem that could be demonstrated, something that makes the system rotten. And I just, in my, you know, nearly 11 years of practice, I can't say that I've ever seen anything that calls for that.
Matthew Rich, attorney, thanks for taking the time to join us, and we appreciate the perspective, as always, here.
Oh, my pleasure. My pleasure, Evan, and nice talking to you as well, David.
Thanks, Matt. You too.
And so we got Matt's view of it. Dave, you're now paid for your opinion, which as a reporter, you're still getting used to. If you're just joining us, we're talking to Dave Andreotta from the Democrat and Chronicle, his column, Village Judges Shouldn't Be Village Idiots. You can find it in democratandchronicle.com. I hope you're a subscriber, and that's a whole other conversation, not just to boost the Democrat and Chronicle, but because media does need, consumers do need to make choices by voting with their wallets, whether you're a member of WXXI or a subscriber. But anyway, you can find it there, or I've posted a link to it on my Twitter page, at Evan Dawson. You're paid for your opinion now. So before we get to our next guest very briefly here, yes or no, if you had the power today, would you make the change? Would you require local justices to have a law degree, and would you go to that district model?
Well, without
without knowing more, I know.
Okay, I will say yes, yes, ideally. No, maybe practically. However, there is one thing that I think can be implemented that the commission suggested in 2008. It was never done.
What was
because
that?
The political appetite for it wasn't there. And the solution was to offer criminal defendants the right to opt out of justice court and to go before a judge that is a lawyer.
Okay,
and
so
that was never implemented. And so, that to me would be a compromise that I could live with.
Okay, so instead of saying all justices, even on the town court and village level, have to have law degrees, you get the option. You're in front of them, and that person does not have a law degree. You can opt out and say, I want a judge who does.
And the vast majority of these cases are traffic cases. I suspect most people would not want to go to that length. But in cases that are involving serious criminal matters, it would make sense to me.
All right, let's bring in David Bookstaver, who's been waiting patiently. And David is a spokesman for the New York State Office of Court Administration. David, thanks for waiting and taking the time, and I appreciate your time this afternoon.
It's my pleasure. Pleasure to be here, Evan. And I think Matt Rich did a good job of making it a thoughtful conversation, as well as you guys. I think that I just wanted to start off by correcting a few things that I heard. And the first thing is that the Magistrates Association does not do the training. The training is under the auspices of the Town and Village Resource Center, i.e. the state court system. And the training is extensive. The judges get 6 intensive days of training. The non-lawyers must pass a test. And they get training each year. 12 hours of training must be done each year. So I think we've made great strides in trying to make sure the judges who do a yeoman's job day in, day out, get the training they need.
David, when it comes to, Matt Rich mentioned a hotline and essentially a number for local justices to call if they have questions. How often does that get used?
It gets used all the time. In fact, you know, I get calls from the Town and Village judges because I've done some of the media training for them. I have them call me. And I think the judges feel very comfortable having that hotline to the Town and Village Resource Center. They have been trained, if you don't know, they're trained not to shoot from the hip, as one of your guests said they do. They can take a 2-minute break, call the resource center, and always get somebody to say, here's the best course of action. And I don't – look, these judges, as I said to Dave, and I think he put in his column, they want to do the right thing. They're doing this often in the evenings. They are part of their community. And let's not forget, they're elected by their constituents in the town. And so that hotline gets used all the time, to answer your question.
Okay, and is I want to phrase this the right way here. When you look at the New York Times reporting from a few years back that we've referenced, when you look at Dave's column in the Democrat and Chronicle, when you highlight what some of these more egregious cases of judges sort of really going out of bounds. I mean, I talked about a judge in a small town telling a woman that occasionally denying an order of protection because, quote, every woman needs a pounding every now and then. That, thankfully, that is a very, very rare instance. Are we doing a disservice by putting too much light on those cases, and does that lessen the public trust in local judges?
Look, obviously I'm going to say yes, but I that's my answer. But as I said to Bill Glaberson, who wrote the story, as I said to Dave, I think there has to be some context. So, you know, no one ever writes a story about a dog that bites a person. But if a person bites a dog, well, that's news. So it is easy to find the tiny percentage of instances like you brought up or Dave brought up in his column. It wouldn't be much of a news story to and a headline to say town and village judges to handle tens of thousands of cases and are pillars of their community and really doing what we want folks to do, which is, you know, public service. Well, that's not a story, is it? It should be. And I appreciate Dave including the line in his story that these folks are the salt of the earth because they are. And no one is paying attention to the tens of thousands of cases that go just as they're supposed to, some of them very difficult. And you know, the other part of your conversation, let's say these folks had to travel 15, 18, 20 miles to go to a district court. I've been upstate during the winter. I would be happy to have this resolved by my local magistrate in my town so that I'm not traveling 40 miles to deal with a moving violation.
Dave, I should let Dave Andreotta have a response to that. I mean, he's saying that, look, we don't put enough light on the vast majority of the good, hardworking people.
Well, but I'm not sure that it's a news story either when planes land on time. Do you know what I mean? Now we're getting into a debate about whether.
Well, once a year you can have a story that says, you know, 99.998% of planes landed on time, and the next time you see a plane crash, don't freak out because you're not likely to be on it. That's also fair, isn't it?
I suppose, but I'll take a different tact here. That I agree with David in that. And by the way, David and I have I can't say enough about the help that he's been to me through the years. So we have a very good working relationship.
Yes,
for two people who in professions that are sometimes adversarial. So I like David. He's been very helpful. But on the note that these justices oversee tens of thousands of cases a year, that is correct. You can't deny that. But they are disciplined at a far greater rate than their docket share would suggest. I mean, they are handling far fewer cases actually than state judges, and they're being disciplined at a much higher rate. And the folks who are being disciplined generally are non-attorneys. Just to bring it around.
Is that wrong, David Bookstaver?
To be honest, I don't have those facts in front of me. But I do want to make something clear. The Commission on Judicial Conduct, which is a separate entity from the court system, and I don't speak for them, but I can tell you that they don't, on any level, address judicial decisions, the legal decisions. It's the Commission on Judicial Conduct. And so there is there's somewhat of a wall there that I want to make clear. So, you know, and I believe, you know, Matt Rich addressed this. If a judge makes a decision that is wrong on the law, the remedy is not the Commission on Judicial Conduct. The remedy is appellate review, and we have that in all levels of our court system. And so I think it's important to be clear and make that distinction.
We're talking to Dave Andreotta, who wrote the column in the Democrat and Chronicle about local judges, and that has a lot of us talking. And on the phone with us is David Bookstaver, a spokesman for the New York State Office of Court Administration. I'm going to get to the phones in just a second, and I'm going to do a little bit of housekeeping on the air and pull back the curtain a little and say that I think the host made a mistake today. I thought, because I couldn't convince any judges to come on the air with me, that we wouldn't have enough oxygen to go for the entire hour. And there's an excellent Democrat and Chronicle reporter named Justin Murphy, who I invited to come over and talk about a totally separate subject, and poor Justin is waiting to talk about that. And now we've got more than I can even deal with to get through the hour. And so I hope Justin is listening right now. You're going to have to blame Dave Andreotta, Justin, and I'm going to beg Justin to come back at a separate time because I can't get away from this and I don't want to miss any of the callers who are calling in. So, Dave Andreotta, will you deliver the message for me?
You got it.
An olive branch, and can you blame yourself?
I will.
Okay.
I'll take the heat.
This is, let me get back to the phones, Don in Waterloo. Go ahead, Don. Oh, see, Don is listening off the air. This is a good lesson for callers here. Don, turn the radio down. Listen over the phone. If you call the show, there you are.
Yep.
Thanks for calling, and
you
go
got
ahead.
It.
There you go. But you can please can turn the radio 40. Down. Turn the radio down, Don. Go ahead.
Yep.
Are you there, Don? Go ahead.
Yep, I am. Yes, my name is Dan, and I've been a New York State resident my entire life. And I've been kind of a traffic outlaw. And I've never had a problem with these courts. My question is, why the funding? It seems like New York State has taken all the funding from the local courts, what they generate in fines. And how can we expect to have better qualified people when there is, you know, no funding for them? The state takes it away.
I don't know how to answer that. Dave or Dave? David Bookstaver?
Well, these are local municipality courts. These are not state-paid judges. They're not state-paid courts.
I know that, but the state still gets the money. I know many small villages that have gotten rid of their justices of the peace because they don't get to keep any money for the funding for their courts.
I'm sorry.
Whatever funding they generate from fines and court fees, all of it goes to the state now.
That's the question I had for you, Don. What sort of monies are you talking about? You're talking about fines from traffic violations?
Yes, fines from traffic courts. You know, I've never had any problem serious with a JP. I've always been guilty, so I never argue.
Well, that's very upstanding of you.
I know that they've taken a lot of money away, the state, over the years to make up for their budget mistakes.
Mr. Bookstaver, what do you think?
I will be honest with you. I thought some of the revenue from these local infractions stayed with the town. But this is not a court system issue, and so I'm going to steer clear of it, to be honest.
That's fair enough. We've got a few minutes left here as we talk about the piece. And again, if you're just joining us, you can jump on my Twitter feed and find Dave Andreotta's piece that has us all talking, or on democratandchronicle.com. Or better yet, you could subscribe to the Democrat and Chronicle if you'd like. And your column appears when, Dave?
Sundays.
On Sundays. Okay.
And Evan, can I just jump in on one other issue? Look, you know, the debate about should all these town judges be lawyers? I think that if you look at some of the courts around the state, there are no lawyers maybe living in that town, in that area. And even if there were, you can't say, well, Bob or Sue, you're a lawyer. You must do
that. Yeah, you're the only lawyer in town. You got the job.
Right. So, it's a fine intellectual debate. But the reality is the system we have, I would say, more than by and large, the system works.
But David,
and it creates an environment for folks to not have to go great distances to, like your last caller, who had a couple of speeding tickets, I guess. He wanted to take care of it.
But Dave Andreotta's idea that, again, the one that he is endorsing, is the notion of at least a compromise that says, okay, the picture you're painting is accurate, and you might not be able to find a lawyer in every town, but if you give a defendant the option of appearing in front of a judge who does have a law degree, then you go a long way towards sort of assuaging some of those concerns.
And I think Dave Andreotta answered why that didn't happen very, very acutely.
I'm confused about that. Why would that not be?
I think he said that, you know, it was a matter of political will. That would have required some legislative changes.
Yeah, but that's a lack of political will, to me, is always a poor excuse for whether something is a good idea, isn't it? I mean, I think you're saying practically it's probably not.
We thought it was a good idea, but it was a solution that task force came up with.
Yes.
And I can tell you that a lot of very bright people that I work with spent a lot of time on that. And that besides that one suggestion, there were a number of suggestions that were, in fact, put into practice. There is much better oversight. We have supervising judges, in other words, state-paid judges in every district, that have taken on or under their wing the town and village courts to monitor them more closely. And that's in addition to the Town and Village Resource Center. So while these courts don't fall under the auspices of the state courts and the Office of Court Administration, we do our level best to make sure they have the support that they need and that we can offer to address some of the issues that Bill Glaberson raised over a decade ago.
David Bookstaver, spokesman for the New York State Office of Court Administration, thank you for taking the time to join us on the program today, David.
Thank you very much.
Dave Andreotta, I'll give you the final word here as we've got just about a minute left here. He says political will prevent that last compromise, and I understand the point, but what do you think?
Well, I know that David's off the air now, but it was my impression too that even the commission that was appointed by the Chief Justice at the time, Judith Kaye, came up with this solution. It was my impression that the Office of Court Administration, I'm almost reluctant to go there without David on the air. I'd like to have that debate, but it was my impression that Kaye herself was not willing to sign on to that. I'm not sure of the exact reasons. I know that there was a lack of political will. There are a lot of people. It's important to know that a lot of these justices are tied into the local political scene, and that's no secret. And that local political scene then will filter up to Albany, and I think that's the reason that we have this political will issue, that it's not going anywhere. And Judge Kaye didn't sign on to it, is my impression.
You've been a columnist for only about a month and a half, I think, and you've gotten us talking all the time here already, Dave. So you can read him on Sundays in the Democrat and Chronicle. That's where the columns are. Though you've kept your other hat on reporting as well. So
yes.
So you can read him often, is the point. Thank you for taking the time to come in and spend an hour with us, David.
Thanks for having me, Evan.
And short break now. We're coming back with a very different topic. For those of you dreaming about walking out of work wherever you are today, we may have an answer for you on what to do next.